Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, musical theater superstar David Campbell joins us from Australia. Also, Broadway producer Brian Hugh Mackey from A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder is with us. Today is interviews only, so please stay tuned.
Has been a test. I cannot see the reason, but maybe knowing I don't know is part of getting through. I try to do what's best, and faith has made it easy to see the best thing I can do is put my trust in you, for you know.
With us today, we have a special guest coming to us from Australia, is international superstar David Campbell. David, thank you so much for taking time. You know, the 14-hour time change, we've been trying to schedule this for months, and I'm glad that you're able to do it as well as us.
But we did it, and I think that's the most important thing. How good is technology?
Oh, you know, we love, you know, we wouldn't have been able to do this just 10 years ago.
No, it would have been really hard and really expensive, and there would have been phone calls, and we might have had to go through a calling company, and it would have been a headache, and now this is awesome.
So, you know, 10 years ago, we would have had to call Sony and work with your reps and fly you first class, and you need 18 M&Ms in a glass jar and things like
exactly.
that.
I still need the M&Ms, but everything else is gone.
Well, good. Excellent. So you are taking time out of your schedule to talk about your new album, David Campbell Sings John Bocchino. And tell us about how this project came to be.
It came, you know, I'd left Sony. I'd been recording with them and been with them for about 10 years and had a really great time with the company. But, you know, my contract lapsed and there was talk about renewing it. And I had an inkling about, like, I wanted to try something a bit more independent. I was curious about the model. I was actually a big fan of that sort of going more direct to fans thing that has been very much set up in America with comedy acts like Louis C.K. and acts like that. I found that really fascinating. And I, you know, that's very much unheard of here in Australia. And so I thought, you know, if you go smaller, there must be a way of doing that. So I would set up this label, my wife and I, Luckiest Records, and just thought, look, what would be the first thing? If I had my dream, what would be the good first album to do? And I said I really wanted it to be something fun and something that was memorable. It doesn't have to be too big. You know, and we were talking, and I was like, God, I wish I could have recorded with John all those years ago. I never really did it. And Lisa's like, just call him and ask him, find out what he's doing. And he just got back from doing he'd been commissioned to do a piece for Denmark called Aswara, and he'd just gotten back recently from doing that. And I said, look, here's the idea. Do you want to come to Australia and record an album? And we'll do a few shows at the Cabaret Festival. And we have a musical theater cabaret venue here in Sydney that my wife and I now are part of. And I said, yeah, we can get up a little mini tour and we'll just see what happens. We'll put it out there and, you know, we'll make music and it'll be fun and we can control it, more importantly. And he was all for it.
So you got that going, and how long did this entire process take, and what were the surprises like, you know, versus coming from Sony to do it on your own? I know that all of a sudden there's the making of an album is many more tiny steps than people think about. So what was your experience like?
You know, the best thing about my time at Sony to my time now is what I learned from doing. You know, I recorded a cast recording for the show that I was sort of had made my name in Australia, a show called Shout, which is a like an early jukebox musical of 2000, 2001. And that's how I got signed to Sony. And I did a pop album for a few years that didn't get released. And then I released a lot of swing albums and sort of I did a Broadway record with Rob Fisher and, you know, some people over in New York. So I'd had a lot of recording time and through that, it really threw me into the process of how to do it, more so than when I was living in New York and just doing a cast recording once in a while. I got far more experience, and I think that really helped for this. It meant that I knew exactly what I needed from the studio. You know, John and I produced this record, so ourselves. So it was easy to go straight to what I wanted and what the vision was and how to pre-produce it and who to go to what studios to go to, what I wanted the sound to be, what microphones to use. All that sort of stuff was far easier because I could control it. And I knew this wasn't going to be a big album. I didn't want it to be a big album. I thought I wanted this to be intimate. I wanted it to feel like, you know, great cabaret records that I loved in the 90s, or albums like Jimmy Webb's 10 Easy Pieces or the Tony Bennett and Bill Evans album. You know, I had a few touchstones of sonically where I wanted it, or even emotionally where I wanted this album to be, which I thought would benefit John's music and the sound that I wanted to go for singing it. So actually there was a lot of advantages of what I learned from the label that I could apply being an independent artist. And the most important thing was cost effective and speed.
So how did you originally hook up with John?
When I first got to New York in the 90s, I sort of went over there for 3 weeks through some connections. I met Michael Feinstein and I in Australia, and I'd done the Barbara Cook Masterclass in Australia that she'd done, which was this big public event. For some reason it was. And Michael got me into the cabaret convention over there in New York in the 90s. So I was there for a couple of weeks to do some shows at 88s, and I was going around seeing performers, and I saw Amanda McBroom. In my head, she was doing like the smaller room in Carnegie Hall. There's like a little tiny room they used to do cabaret in, but
sure.
John doesn't remember it that way, but that's what I remember. And he got up and did one of his songs, Sweet Dreams, with her. And I sort of pestered him. And we got talking, and I was like, you know, I was a really big fan of his music and was trying to like say, hey, what other songs have you got? I'm from Australia. And he was sort of a bit standoffish with me and was a bit like, he was a bit, you know, he was hesitant to sort of get to know me. But we shared a cab uptown because I was staying up near him, and we had a coffee, and then we got talking, and then I sang for him. And we've known each other for 17 years. And for me, it feels almost stupid that I haven't recorded a whole album of his material earlier, because here is one of my closest friends who's one of the, I think personally, one of the best songwriters to come out of the last 30, 40 years in America. And I haven't utilized that as a singer and an interpreter. It's very, I feel very foolish to do it so late.
Okay. So you came to New York and you did a few things, among them playing the Rainbow Room. Wasn't the Rainbow Room?
Yeah. I did 2 years at the Rainbow Room. And yeah.
That was a beautiful venue. And, excuse me. Then you did, Stephen Sondheim's Saturday Night.
Yeah.
What was that like? What was your experience in that? Did you work directly with Sondheim during this time?
Steve was very closely associated with it. I got cast because he'd seen me do Babes in Arms at Encores, and that was with Kathleen Marshall, and Kathleen was directing this at Second Stage. She was directing the Sondheim piece, and so he basically, it was the first time I'd been cast without having to audition, which I'm not sure if I had to audition for Sondheim how I would have coped, and if indeed I would have gotten the role. So luckily I didn't have to do that, and didn't know that he was there in the audience of Babes and Arms to see me. But he was very hands-on, you know, my experience with Steve, and I spoke to him the other day to send him a copy of this album. And as usual, when you write to Sondheim, he writes straight back to you. I mean, yes. It's astounding to someone like me over the other side of the world who's sort of, you know, worshipped this guy from afar. And I've had worked with him several times, and he's still very like, yes, that'd be great. Please send it to this address. That still blows me away. But working with him, it's very direct and very, he's very specific, but he was very hands-on. And I remember very much being in the rehearsal room with Chris Fitzgerald and you know, and all of us there, and him very much sitting back and enjoying the experience. I don't know what he was like working on other shows, but because this was his first show Saturday Night, it was the first time being performed in New York, to my knowledge. It had been done in London prior to that.
Yeah.
It was like he was reliving the memories of writing it. He was you know, he was giggling at, you know, things in the script or at lyrics. You know, he seemed to be really just enjoying watching it, as opposed to being there and rewriting it or reshaping it. It was not a passive approach, because sometimes he would give you a note and that note would be quite direct. And there was a few times he would be very specific with me, or he'd come over and say, oh, that was wrong, change it and go this way. And, you know, give me very clear and succinct places to go. But my big memory of Steve in that time was him just sort of, you know, head back or with a book or, you know, sort of reading and looking up and giggling and laughing and going back to what he was doing. It was, you know, it was very, and we're just all there knowing that Sondheim's in the room. All of us, we were very young, you know, and being very much like looking at each other doing the scene. But even though we were trying to act as much as we could, sometimes I could see, well, I knew I was putting this out there. It's like, he's just over there, everybody, in this scene. It's Stephen Sondheim's in the corner. And yeah, so it was good. It was a cute little production.
Had you before or since done any other Sondheim shows?
I did Company here in Australia. Mm-hmm. For a production company called Kookaburra, who set themselves up to be a big musical theatre force in Australia. And so we all tried to chip in. And he flew out to see it.
Wow.
And we caught up then and hung out then. It was an unfortunate situation where then there was no understudies and somebody got sick and a decision was made by the producers to cut it. And we all got to cut some parts of the score, and it all got into this major controversy. So that was kind of marred by that, but it was enjoyable. I enjoyed doing Company very much, you know, being, you know, a little bit older and doing another Sondheim and saying that I'd kind of worked with him twice. You know, that's something you don't get to say very often, you know, and to say that I've got his email and I can send him stuff and he just writes back to me. These things, just as a bit of a nerd and a musical theatre nerd and someone who used to subscribe to the Sondheim Review, these things make me very happy.
So tell us about Encore's Babes in Arms. That's 1999, was it?
Yeah. I remember auditioning as clear as day, and I remember thinking, I really get this and get the role and get, you know, that was just Mickey and Judy putting a show on in the barn. And it was wonderful, you know. We got to work with Mary Rogers, was very involved at the time, and you know, she was very, once again, she was, you know, enjoying the sort of memory of a piece like this being staged. You know, it was a very idyllic production. I remember really floating on air the whole time. I mean, I got to work with Aaron Dilley, who, sure, you know, to this day is still one of my favorite leading ladies I've had to work with. I mean, we just had something. We just clicked. We were, you know, we're BFFs during the production, and I just adored singing to her every night. It was just, she just has one of those faces that light up, and I thought we had a great chemistry, and you know, it was great. We got to, you know, I got to meet with the great Chris Fitzgerald and his wife Jess, and we were all there when they first kissed in the room, so we all saw the romance happen, and now they have kids. And so it was just one of those great things, and to work with Kathleen and do Encores and start a relationship with someone as great as Rob Fisher, who then, you know, he and I did my Broadway album for Sony a few years back, where we recorded that. You know, it's very funny, you know, when I think about that, I'm all the way here in Australia, and it was a period of time when I lived there in New York, and you guys are very loyal. You know, I mean, you sit there and you can pick up the phone to people like, you know, Scott Gorenstein or, you know, Rob Fisher or these people and say, hey, how you guys doing? Or John Bacchino. And like, what's going on? Let's do something. You want to create something? Let's do it. And that, you know, I really cherish that, you know, 17 years down the track.
So tell me about your initial move from Australia to New York and the move from Australia, I mean, from New York back to Australia. Start us with Australia to New York first. How did that come about? Was it the cabaret first?
It was the cabaret, yeah. I was trying to get a foot in here. And my father is a very famous rock and roll performer in this country. It's like being – when I was living there, the only equivalent I can think of is like being Bruce Springsteen's son. So it's a working class hero who means so much to the general populace here that it's crazy. I wasn't singing that stuff, and I certainly didn't want to ride on his coattails. Although, at the time, you know, he and I had a very fractured relationship. We weren't close and we weren't fighting, but it was just strange. So, And, you know, he and I are extremely close now, and I just recorded on his album 2 weeks ago. But it took a while for me, I think, to find my own feet. It was just a typical, you know, guy thing when you're going through your 20s with your father, when your father just happens to be a legend. So I wasn't – and also I was struggling. I was started as an actor in Australia, and I had – a good little bit of success, and that made me want to keep going. And I started singing, and I had people that would come and see me, but I got some terrible reviews here. You know, at the time, cabaret here in Australia wasn't going through the rejuvenation that it was in New York in the 90s, and where people were really germinating towards it again. And people like Michael Feinstein had reignited it. It was seen very much here. And one review from a major paper here saying the cabaret, you know, that I shouldn't be doing it. The cabaret is for the great dames of theatre and the people who have lived, and what's a young whippersnapper like me doing this for? And so that, you know, I thought, wow, this is really tough. But a few people believed in me, and I got to somebody here called Leo Schofield, a great sort of arts guy here who's had a very long and varied career in many areas of the arts, said, look, he was doing the Melbourne Festival, and he brought out Barbara Cook, and she was doing a workshop, for singers. And he asked me if I would be one of the singers in front of all these people. And I said, sure. And Michael Feinstein was there, and he saw me and he said, come to New York, like I said before. So I, on a whim, I came to New York, and Alex Rybak had seen me do a show and said, we should do 88s down in the Village, and, you know, we'll get a couple, you know, people along and see you. So I planned to come for 3 weeks, and in that time, you know, some people saw me. As things happen in New York, you start a fire, and it goes like it just burns through sometimes, and sometimes it doesn't. And I was lucky enough that something happened, and people connected to me, and that validated what I believed. And I loved singing this sort of material, and finally felt like I was finding a spiritual home, and people were connecting to that, and I was getting auditions and thinking, oh my God, I've got to try and get a green card now, and doing workshops and working with Maury Esten in workshops. And, you know, I was a kid from Australia. I'd been there for a couple of weeks and my head was spinning. So I thought, okay, well, I have to make the most of this. And I got a green card, and things escalated from there to what you heard. But soon after, during Saturday night, I'd been living there for 3.5 years off and on, flying back and forth to Australia. And, you know, it was never part of my plan to live in New York, even though I loved it. And, you know, I still love going there and still love being a part of it. When I say it was never part of my plan, it was never something I'd set out to do. And so, I was going through just a bit of a crisis. It started during Saturday night, and I was doing workshops with Thoroughly Modern Millie, and all these sort of things were happening, and it was very exciting, but I just felt lonely, and I felt like I didn't have the heart to keep going emotionally there. And that was a very confronting thing, because basically, as you can imagine, everyone's looking at me going, don't be crazy, don't go back to Australia. And I made the decision to go, no, I think I have to do this. This is the right thing for me at this time. And I made that call. And sometimes my wife, who's a theater producer here, sometimes goes, do you ever regret that? I'm like, no, you know, what are you going to do? I did it. I don't know if that was the right career move if I was advising my younger self at the time, but I'm certainly happy. And it's been a wild journey all the way up to there and post there. But as I said, you know, it's not like I've lost contact there. And doing things like when I ran the Adelaide Cabaret Festival with my wife, you know, we were bringing out, you know, a lot of Broadway people, and Stephen Schwartz and John Pacino, and, you know, we're doing all that again and reconnecting, and then doing the Broadway album and doing this. It seems that I keep coming back and forth there now. And now that we're also doing things like, you know, we've set up a theater here called the Hayes Theater Company, my wife and I and a few other producers, which is kind of the first off-Broadway exclusive musical theater house for Sydney. Hmm. So we only do musical theater and cabaret.
Wow.
And our first production here has already been nominated for 8 Helpman Awards. That was our first production, which is Sweet Charity. first thing we did. And so now we're thinking, you know, we're bringing out and talking to a lot more people about what we can do to connect with New York again. So I keep, you guys keep dragging me back in every time I,
every time you get out, we suck you back in.
It's like Godfather, it's like Godfather 3, you guys, but God, better. Thank God, God.
Godfather 4, the musical. So, you mentioned that your dad was a rock and roll singer, and you also you made a quick passing reference that you can't sing that music. And I want to disagree with you on that, is that I've heard some maybe unofficial fan recordings of you singing rock, and it's pretty good. So what did you do with your dad a couple of weeks ago? You said you recorded with your dad a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, right. Well, I've done a couple of things with him. We do a lot of charity stuff together, and we have done a few things together. We love singing together now. It's a lot of fun.
It's great.
He and I did a song for his album a few years back where we did a cover of Wichita Lineman. Mm. And this time he's done it. It's 30 years that he was in a very massive band that made his name here. And then the band broke up in 83, and he went solo. So in 84. So this is the 30th anniversary of him being solo. So he's doing an album with Keith Urban, and the guys from Journey have done a track, and all these people. And so he's asked me to be on that with all these other Australian singers as well. And then so we did this rock song, which Desmond Childs wrote in the 80s for one of his albums. And it's like an Aerosmith B-side. It's fabulous, this song, but it's an absolute blitzer to sing. It's just like as high as you want to be, and just me and him just trading off. So it's a lot of fun.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah. Any good power ballads between the father and son that will make the audience choke up?
It's kind of it's very strange. I can see the clip now, and it's like, you know, there's a lot of like denim. There's a lot of double denim in the clip, you know, a lot of looking in mirrors and bars and throwing glasses and smashing it. There's a lot of that stuff.
Well, you know, it has to be. So I want to mention to folks out there that if you want to catch up with David, he's got a great Facebook page. Just look for David Campbell on Facebook, or catch up with him on Twitter at DavidCampbell73. Also, DavidCampbell.com will take you to a little video and also SoundCloud sound clip that you can listen to part of his album. And do that. So, David, now that we're, you know, we've talked a little bit about your career and on stage and everything like that, I hear that, you know, the Australian press is very much like the British press, isn't it? I guess because of Mr. Murdoch, really.
We're all one with Rupert.
Yes, and all the scandal and all the stuff that happens out there. And I hear that you and Lisa made a big announcement. What was that announcement?
Yeah, we are expecting twins.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Yeah.
Double trouble.
Double trouble, double happiness. But there, we have a son, Leo, who is amazing.
How old really, is Leo?
Leo is 4, and he's a real character. He's great fun, and he thinks that the theater that we work at is his theater. So we know we're doomed with him already to be a theater tragic. But there are twins on my wife's side, which I kind of knew but didn't really know. So when we started planning a second child, that didn't really enter into my head until she was showing quite early. And we're like, wow, that's really interesting. She goes, you do remember there are twins. My grandfather's a twin and my cousins are twins. I'm like, oh, my God, I think we're in trouble, or we're lucky, depending on how you look at it.
That is wonderful, wonderful news. When is the due date?
We are due – well, they come early with twins. Unfortunately, they have to get out early. So they're due on her birthday, which is the 11th of January, so which is also her mother's birthday. So if they go that long, it could be, you know, a little triple bit of history there for her side of the family.
And unlike here, on the 11th of January, you could have a brilliant, shiny, sunny day there.
Yeah, she'll probably want to get them out. It'll be pretty hot here in the 11th of January. It'll be over 100 degrees here at that time.
Oh, my goodness gracious. So that's congratulations to you and to Lisa. I appreciate you taking the time to give us a call from Australia. And
anytime. You know, we're not paying for this. This is just on Skype. We can do this weekly.
Well, I might take you up on that. You know, we have to talk about the Australian theater scene. It's been very hard to find somebody down there to get us in touch with that. I've always
Please let me know. I'd love to do that.
I've always meant to ask somebody from Australia. You know, Broadway has, you know, the U.S. has Broadway and the U.K. has the West End. What is the theater scene called in Australia? Is there a name for it?
We don't have a name for it. Some people might say it's Melbourne at the moment. They seem to be the ones with all the big shows. Unfortunately, Sydney don't have enough big houses at the moment. And there's a lot of lobbying from Cameron McIntosh and big producers like John Frost here to get another big house, a big sort of Broadway-style house going. But at the moment, everything there is a little strip in Melbourne where they're all in the city all together. So that seems to be where everything's starting from at the moment. There's been a trend back towards Melbourne the last 7 or 8 years. So that seems to be where Les Mis just started up again. And that seems to be where it's all happening.
I meant to ask you, it was on my list of questions and I missed it. So, working with Cameron and doing the big shows, all around, what was that like? What was your first big Cameron show?
You know, the funny thing is, and this is one of those things, I had lunch with him the other day. He's one of those people that is, we call him, you pick and stick with people here in Australia. Mm-hmm. And he's one of those people too. He always will catch up and say hi. I did Les Mis. I was Marius and in 97 for the 10th anniversary production. And then I went and did Hey Mr. Producer for him in London. And sang with Les Salonga and did Martin Guest. So, you know, here I was again just standing around with all these amazing people who I used to listen to learn how to sing, and there they all were, and I was singing with them. And I got to meet the Queen, which is camp. I mean, I've met a lot of queens, but, you know, she's really takes the cake. And he's just great, and he's been just gave me a bit of advice on the theater and producing side the other day as well, because he knows what we're trying to do and is very supportive of it. So, you know, but he's a really great guy. Indefatigable, just like energy is always the same with Cameron every time I see him. I don't know how he does it.
That's wonderful. So, David, thank you so much for joining us, and we hope I will catch up with you in a couple of months. Let's talk about what's happening in the Australia theater scene, okay?
Let's do it.
All right. Have a great day.
Thanks, James.
I've got a warm place to sleep. Some nights I lie awake counting gifts instead of counting sheep. I've got a heart that can hold love. I've got a mind that can think. There may be times when I lose.
With us this morning, we have a special guest. Ryan Mackey is here with us. Ryan is currently represented on Broadway with The Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, which, you know, you might have heard won 4 Tony Awards, including Best Musical. Previously, Mackey acted as Mel Brooks and Tom Meehan's assistant on The Producers, which we're going to have to get some stories about that. Assistant directed The Boy from Oz and was producer David Binder's assistant on 33 Variations, which starred Jane Fonda. Coming up for him, he's got a new musical based on the true story of the Everly Club, Little Nemo in Slumberland, and a musical based on a Japanese manga. A Japanese manga, that is a comic book, right?
That is correct. Yep.
So, Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So tell us, you know, are you a trust fund kid? Did you come from billions of dollars and decide you're just going to take over Broadway? Or how did you come about becoming a producer of a Tony Award-winning musical?
I am not a trust fund baby, but I used to work for billionaires, actually. That story in a little bit. But I had discovered my family was the furthest thing from theater. I grew up in Aurora, Illinois, which is about 40 miles away from Chicago.
Wayne and Garth?
Yes, totally. Okay. Most famous thing from Aurora, besides me now. We just never went to any theater. It wasn't part of our culture. But my sister, one day when I was about 10, stole us away, my little sister and I, to her high school to watch her high school performance of Little Shop of Horrors. Mm-hmm. And I was immediately blown away. They had rented the plant from the Off-Broadway production and did all these special effects. And it just, I was enthralled. I was obsessed, actually. My sister can attest to that, that once I sat down and watched that show, it just wouldn't stop at all. Everything that I would do centered around musicals. So I started with Little Shop, which took me, and now we're in 1989. So that's the rise of, well, the British invasion. So I immediately gravitated towards Lloyd Webber and Bublil and Schoenberg, and it just kind of just kept snowballing. I would anything that I got for Christmas or my birthday had to be related to Broadway musicals. So it was very obvious to my family that, wait, what's going on here? this is all new. Should we be worried? But they just took it in stride. They just gave me the space to kind of figure it all out. And I would hide away in my room, teaching myself how to play the piano, which I did, and tried to replicate all the musicals that I was listening to. And in the meantime, creating my own little musicals too. So that's where it was born out of, was just that one time, and that just sucked me in.
Well, that's I think that we all have very similar stories.
Oh yeah,
similar stories to that. Isn't it interesting how we all come to Mothership, New York City?
Yes.
And when was the first time you did, Ryan?
What? Say that again.
When was the first time you did come to New York City?
The first time I came to New York City was 1997. Or 98. I came out here with my best friend from high school, mm-hmm. and we went to go see the Tony Awards. They had tickets available, and I bought tickets. We lied to her parents and said we were going with my older sister, but it literally was 2 17-year-old kids in New York City alone.
Everybody has to go through stages like that.
Oh, my God, sure. It was amazing. Went to the Tony Awards. And
so are you saying your first Broadway show was the Tony Awards?
My first Broadway show was Titanic.
Uh-huh, okay.
And then the Tony Awards, and then Lion King. It was all in that same week. It was Lion King, Tony Awards, Titanic, and Scarlet Pimpernel.
Which version?
I know. I was going to say, I think it was 2.0 then. And she, my friend still gives me shit for not taking her to Cabaret, because that's the year of Cabaret as well.
Well, you can take her now. It's the same thing.
Totally. I didn't think about that.
So let's flash forward to 2008, and you are selling subscriptions in the sales department at the Public Theater. How did you end up in that job, and tell us what happened in 2008?
Sure. So throughout the years, whenever I wasn't working on any shows or anything that was stimulating me, I would always fall back on working in a box office of a theater. It started in Chicago at the Royal George Theater, and kind of has always been a part of my life. And so in 2008, while working for David Binder, during the summer, he takes the summer off. Not this summer, seeing how he's got two hit shows, but yeah. Normally he takes the summer off. And so I would go and find something to do. And I found this job working in the call center for the Public Theater selling subscriptions. And I was like, okay, that's easy. I can do this. And a couple of phone calls that I had made, I'm new to like cold call sales at this time, and I still am. And I wasn't very good. I wasn't, I'm a box office person. People come to me. I don't go to them.
Yeah.
And so a couple of calls I had made totally blew up on my face. I just had the wrong approach. But this last call that I remember making one night was to this gentleman on the other end, who I assumed just by listening to him that he was gay. And you should never assume anything. But he was gay. I said, look, you sound gay.
This story has great potential.
You sound gay. And
says a lawyer.
You got to love musicals, right? And he's like, well, you're certainly presumptuous. And I write musicals. And I was like, no way. I'm a budding producer. it budding, you know, I'm working in a call center, so, so I'm totally not, you know, big time producer. And I'm like, well, what are you writing? Give me your pitch. I totally screwed up my pitch, so go away. Go give me yours. And it was A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, and I immediately fell in love with the show. I asked them if we could meet for coffee, and we did. About a month later, we met for coffee. This is Stephen Lutback, mind you. I'm sorry, I should have said that. So Stephen Lutback, the composer of Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder.
Whom you just outed. Okay.
Yeah.
And we meet for coffee, and we just hit it off. He really... At this point, the show, it was a different title. It was going... The time when I came in, it was still Kind Hearts and Coronets, so they still had the rights. And they were trying to figure out what the hell to do. And I had a Rolodex full of names from the years that I've been working through Broadway. And I'm like, here, use my Rolodex, contact everybody. They're not going to listen to me, but they'll listen to you because you're the artist. And he did. And thankfully, he got somebody out of that was a big supporter of the show. It ultimately didn't work out for that producer because eventually the writing team was sued by Canal for Kind Hearts and Coronets. And I don't know if you guys know that story. That's a whole other world. But so that producer ended up leaving the production. And then another producer came on board a couple years later. He got served with the divorce papers. So he had to divest himself of the show. And by now I was with the guys for... 3-4 years. So I finally said, you know what, let me start knocking on some doors and getting the show done. It has to get done. And it took me about a year and a half to find Joey Parnes, but I finally found him. And that's Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder.
And here we are. You know, that straight path to Broadway, that Cinderella overnight success story, right?
Yeah. Totally.
You know, it sounds like maybe you should write a book called A Gentleman's Guide to A Gentleman's Guide to Love and
There is that.
Yeah, I'll pitch that to Lutback, actually. He really wants to, he and Robert want to do a book, so.
You know, your other stories just made me think of, not exactly the same thing, but at Pump Boys and Dinettes the other night, they bring somebody up from the audience because they have a raffle, you know.
Yeah, top of that, too.
And the guy they picked up at the performance I saw was this young guy, and they're like, well, what do you do? And he's like, oh, I'm a musician. And they're like, oh, what kind of music? And he said, musical theater. I play musical theater. And so, you know, huge laugh. And Hunter Foster says, we don't know much about musical theater in these parts. And then he says, but I hear about these shows. I hear about that Hairspray and that, and you know, that book of something. The guy who cuts my hair tells me about that stuff.
So you worked with Mel Brooks and Tom Meehan.
Yeah.
So is that yin and yang? From the outside, it seems like it's controlled anarchy there.
You know, it was like watching a husband and wife team. And Anne was around at the time, too. This was back in Chicago when it was first trying out. I'm originally from the Chicagoland area. So the shows that would come and try out there, I would work on. Mm-hmm. And Mel, actually, I wasn't hired to be Mel's assistant. I was hired to be a production assistant. And so when Mel arrived, he just kind of pointed at me. He was like, you want to be my assistant? I was like, okay. And that was kind of my introduction to celebrity, watching them write in a closed room without anyone around, just hearing everything. It was one of the and my father. I'm sorry, I'm just stumbling because my father had just passed away, not during production. So my dad had just died right before Mel arrived, and it was a very hard time. And sure. I kind of just threw myself into the work. And Mel and Anne were very grandfatherly and grandmotherly in that they were very, very loving and totally attentive to even my needs. And here I am assisting them, and they're the ones saying, what do you need from us?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was very, very story.
Yeah, it was just so sweet and loving, and it was the perfect thing that I needed. I was avoiding dealing with my father's death. And here, you know, they knew what was going on. They had to have known that I wasn't dealing with it. Most of the people in the production knew what had happened. I have this lovely card from everyone, somewhere actually in my house, from everyone on the team from Susan and Mel to the stagehands, just said, you know, the condolence card. And so I've kept that. I only keep a couple things when I do shows, but that was one thing that I definitely kept. It watching them write and do the thing that they do, that show was written before they even sat down in Chicago. That show didn't change much at all. And that was the brilliant thing. Now, there were lines here and there that, you know, I watched Mel and Tom beat out of each other. But for the most part, that thing was done. And that's the amazing thing to watch, because that never happens.
I was going to say, it must be amazing to be involved in something like that, where you just kind of know from the beginning, this is it. This is going to be a huge hit. This is working. That's, you know, there aren't many times, I'm sure, when that happens and it seems so definite, you know, so absolute. Just everything is going right and everyone's in sync and everyone's on the same page. And that must be a truly, you know, for a new show, you know, not a revival. That must have been an extraordinary experience for you.
That and then I don't want to take credit for it, but I remember we were having a meeting after the show, just Mel, Tom, and Anne, and we were just kind of shooting the shit. And I said, you know, hey, I don't mean to outstep my boundaries, but we have this lovely song called That Face. It'd be really cool to see their faces everywhere, projected everywhere. Because it didn't happen in Chicago. But then it ended up happening in New York. I'm like, I don't know if they had listened to me or if Susan had that idea too, but it happened. And so I like to think that I had a little something to do with that.
I don't blame you.
Oh, wow, they took an idea. Now, again, I don't know if it was mine or if it was already thought of, but they were like, oh, that's a great idea.
I don't know. My experience is that theater is much more collaborative than some, say, television or film.
Yeah, it is. In fact, that's what I'm learning now on my next shows, of like how to give them the space, the writers the space, but also help condition the needs that I want, get it out of them. I like to think of myself as a producer. I say creative producer, because a lot of the things that I'm doing are born out of my head or ideas that I might have had years ago. You know, I'm learning as I'm working on the Everly Club with my team, of there are certain things that I really want the show to have. I can't dictate it. I have to learn how to pull it out of them. And it is one of the hardest things I've learned, because I'm such a visual person that I think in stage pictures, and I try to put that together with the story, because story is the most important thing in a show, in any medium. The story is the most important thing. That's your structure. If there's no story, you're screwed. And so I'm learning as a producer of how to manage your creative team, get them to do the best work possible, and then also get the things that you know are going to be golden and could be golden on stage out of the writers without telling them what to do. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah, so that's the curveball I've been learning lately.
But what's interesting is, here you are, somebody who fell in love with Little Shop of Horrors, as you say, Andrew Lloyd Webber, the French guys. Okay, Gentleman's Guide is not that type of musical at all. So obviously your sensibilities reached new levels with this one.
Yeah, it's, you know, to me, when I first read it, the first thing I did when I first read it and heard the score, I leaned over to my partner and I said, this has the potential to make lots of money, not on Broadway, but in the sub-rights world. Because it's one of those shows, you know, right now we have, 16 people on stage? Mm-hmm. And Jefferson plays 8 murdered victim, you know, like, why couldn't we expand that? In a high school, when you have 20 people, oh my God, you have 8 people that can play these roles. You know, it's one of those flexible shows that you don't need. It's not offensive. I mean, for the most part, it's not offensive. But
not in the sexual moments, sense.
Right. And those moments, again, can be cut from the high school version. You know, so it just had this flexibility. Now, the craft is really what took me in. I immediately, you're like, all right, lyrically it's there, melodically it's there, comedically it's there. It's all there, and it really hinges on the director and their performers. The show is there. I mean, the structure, everything about the show is very solid. So it's what people will interpret later on in the subsequent productions. But
all right, but what was the mood with all you people when the show wasn't doing well financially? You got the reviews, no question. You put up a quality product, no question. However, the box office wasn't set afire.
Yeah.
Was anybody particularly nervous, or was just a case of this is all going to work out? We have great confidence in this show. Wait till awards time.
You hit the nail on the head. Yeah, it was. Let's just wait it out. We knew, we had a feeling. Look, if we weren't going to get nominated, we're done. You know, that was it. Like, but we had to get there. And Parnes was great at managing the finances to get us there. So we all kind of had this, we knew right away, the reviews were there, the ticket sales weren't there, but if we kept going and chugging along, hopefully we'll get some nominations and maybe we'll win a few, you know, we had, I don't want to sound cocky. I've always known that it's a very good show and it had a shot depending, you know, you just never know what the season's going to be like. We were very fortunate that nothing was sticking. We stuck and we stuck around.
I mentioned before, I have a friend who works in the box office, and he said that the Tony nominations alone made a tremendous difference.
Yes, it did.
Tremendous difference. And then the win, of course, and he said, I mean, his phrase was that people were given permission to like the show, or just, you know, having all these people say, oh, well, you know, it's got all these nominations, thinking that, oh, well, then that's my guarantee that I, you know, if I spend my whatever $150 that I'm going to see something good and not something I'm not going to like.
Exactly.
And that kind of thing, I think, makes even more difference nowadays with ticket prices as they are, that people do not want to take a chance on something they're not going to like. But with Tony nominations like that, it's that's, I guess, as close to you know, never a guarantee, but you know what I mean.
Oh yeah, yeah, and it's you know, it is an unlikely story for the show. You know, it's not a known title. Mm-hmm. There are no stars. You know, the writing team, the director, everybody is new to Broadway. That's a hard sell. Mm-hmm. So it defied all of that. Now it wasn't necessarily a strong season, so we were able to stand out. But even, I mean, I haven't heard anyone say your show wasn't good.
Yes, I agree.
You never hear that.
I agree.
It's always, you know, you might not love it. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But it's not bad. It's a good show. You enjoy yourself. I've never heard anybody say, I hated that show.
Frankly, neither have I.
So that's a good sign. And that's the word of mouth has always been what was sustaining the ticket sales, even when they were low. It was the word of mouth. Word of mouth has always been positive. So,
and speaking of the title and whether or not it's good or, you know, not, and whether or not it's better than the original title, I was at the Paley Center yesterday for a screening of Once Upon a Mattress and Feathertop, and there was a discussion about how originally Once Upon a Mattress was called The Princess and the Pea. Mm. And then George Abbott apparently wanted to change it to Once Upon a Mattress. And Mary Rogers and Marshall Barrow, whoever, they were hesitant because they thought it was maybe a little silly or smarmy sounding. Uh-huh. And so Mary Rogers went to Richard Rogers and said, what do you think about the title? And she said, we don't think it's the title of a hit. And he said, a hit title is the title of a hit.
Ain't that the truth?
Yeah. All right. Well, folks can find Ryan on Twitter at Silly Boy of Broadway, which is Silly Boy Productions. That's your production company.
Yep.
And thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning. We really appreciate you coming and telling us your story.
Thank you. I appreciate being able to tell it.
All right, Ryan, have a great day.
You too. Take care, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Stop, wait, what? Well, I didn't kill Adelbert Dicequick, though that certainly was my intent. Rather hard to digest that I could be arrested for something that I only meant. And it couldn't be poor Cousin Asquith, for he graciously died on his own. Was that hole in the ice just a bit too precise? Was my presence at Chiselmere known?
Well, that wraps it up for this week.
Michael and Peter will be back next week, so please join us once again.
Stop! Wait, when? I should doubt I was seen in the harbor. Lady Hyacinth fell in so fast. As for Salome's end, all suspicion would send them at once to their backstabbing cast. Did the beastings reveal my deception? Was I seen at the weightlifting hall? How rude to intrude on this lovely reception, for I am the Earl after all. Yes, I am the Earl after all. Though it's come, I concede at a cost. But where was my blunder, my weakness? I wonder, is all of it now to be lost? Is all of it now to be lost? Murdering whom? Lord Adalbert Dicequith, 8th Earl of Highhurst. Stop, wait, who? For the murder of Adalbert Dicequith, were there ever a farce, this is it. I am almost amused I should stand here accused of a murder I didn't commit. But surely the Earl died of a heart attack.
No, your lordship, it was foul play.
Of course I should like to inquire by what method he happened to die. But more to the point, what events now conspire to lead them to think it was I? I've dispatched half a dozen, each one a cousin, all of them quite by design. It is not a defense, it just makes no sense. This murder was not one of mine.